It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Merry Christmas Eve to everyone who celebrates Christmas in our audience. Happy Thursday to everyone else. We have a treat in store for you on this Christmas Eve edition of the Brian Lehrer Show. We pulled together some of our favorite conversations with authors of books released this year, many and varied. We have rocker and actress Carrie Brownstein on what got her to Portlandia, Elizabeth Gilbert with advice for getting past the fear to our creativity. We'll discover a modern telling of Jane Eyre set among Korean Americans in Queens, and we'll hear how the play A Chorus Line once saved New York City. We begin with actor and Tony Award-winning producer Wendell Pierce, who makes maybe the strongest case I've heard for art in times of crisis. Wendell Pierce has entertained audiences with roles in HBO's critically acclaimed series The Wire and Tremé, as well as films such as Selma, Ray, and Waiting to Exhale. But in his new book, The Wind in the Reeds, he writes that what drew him to art wasn't the entertainment factor, but more so the understanding that, quote, being an artist is about having a great impact on the world, and it's not something you can approach casually, unquote. Part memoir, part history lesson, the book takes readers through his connection to the city of New Orleans and his efforts to rebuild his hometown of Pontchartrain Park after Hurricane Katrina. Wendell Pierce joins me now in our studio. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
In your book, you write that New Orleans art, whether in the form of food, the new, unique jazz funeral, or brass bands, helped to restore the one-of-a-kind spirit the city is known for after Katrina. How so?
Well, you know, what thoughts are to the individual, art is as a forum for the society as a whole. It's the place where we reflect on who we are, where we hope to be, our triumphs, our failures, and at the same time, we declare what our values are, and then we act on them. And that is a very powerful thing. It's not just something as trivial as just a piece of entertainment. And that has always been a part of New Orleans history uniquely. Our associate in pleasure clubs, you're familiar with the pleasure part, a parade going down the street, banners flying, good music and all. But it was a benevolent society. The social aid part was the fact that, you know, during segregation, black folks couldn't have access to funeral plots. They didn't have access to health care. And so they pooled their money in these social aid and pleasure clubs. So if your mother takes sick, we'll take care of you. If your father dies, we'll send him off nice. And so it was art as social responsibility, art as social justice, going all the way back to the creation of jazz, these captured Africans who found their freedom in creativity before they even found their own physical freedom. And that was the thing through which they found the power to be insurrectionists, to change their condition. So it's always been a part of our culture in New Orleans, that art was always an act of self-determination, an act of insurrection, an act of revolt, an act of resilience and resurrection. And that's what I wanted to get back to once we were destroyed in the flood of 10 years ago.
And listeners, if you want to talk to Wendell Pierce about that concept that he just laid out, art as healing, art as insurrection, and more, maybe since we were observing the third anniversary of Sandy, which is today in our area,
right?
We didn't bring up in our earlier segment the role of art in recovering from that. So maybe there are some local parallels to what Wendell Pierce is talking about, or any of you who have watched him in Tremé or The Wire or in the movies, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692.
And there was a connection locally because Creative Time, which is a wonderful art-producing entity here, that's responsible for the two beams of light at Ground Zero every year, they produced Waiting for Godot, which was my response to the storm. You know, 20 years from now, I knew that some kid would walk up to me and say, Mr. Pierce, in New Orleans' darkest hour, what did you do? And I knew my response was going to be something with art, because I'm an artist. And so I did Waiting for Godot with Creative Time in the Lower Ninth Ward.
I didn't know about that, and I was really surprised to see that in the book. Beckett's existentialist,
yes.
What is the meaning of life? No action play. How does it relate to Hurricane Katrina.
The resonance was just so immediate and so profound and so cathartic is the reason that gave me the impetus to even write this snapshot of a memoir. These people from disparate walks of life, rich and poor, white and black, longshoremen next to lawyers, came to this hallowed ground where thousands of people had died, hundreds of people have died in the Lower Ninth Ward. This vast emptiness, this void, as described in the play, was now a reality for us. Destroyed blocks and homes and lives, that, like I said, I consider it hallowed ground in the Lower Ninth Ward. And in that play, in that moment, there's a line that I had to speak. At this place, in this moment of time, all mankind is us. Let us do something while we have the chance. And like the two characters in the play who are looking for something outside of themselves to resurrect themselves, they realized that the power was going to come from within, because while they waited for Godot, they ultimately realized he would never come, like FEMA never came, like the lack of response would never come to the city that in our darkest hour. And so we realized, as New Orleanians, as people of the community, we had to declare and exercise our own right of self-determination. So it was a very cathartic moment in my life and for the people that were there. And that was the thing that made me act.
It's also, I think, for a lot of people who are into Waiting for Godot and Beckett, that old play, which I read and saw in high school a million mm-hmm. years ago and came out thinking, well, this is, an absurdist play in the sense that it leaves us thinking that there is no meaning to life, ultimately, in Beckett's point of view. You picked out a line that kind of gives the lie to that interpretation, the one you just recited. At this place, in this moment in time, all mankind is us. Let us do something while we have a chance. If that yes. isn't a statement about the meaning of life, nothing is.
And that's the thing that makes that moment and that play so classic, the fact that it can speak to that humanity within us across space, across time. Mr. Beckett wrote it when he was under Nazi occupation. It spoke to the city of Sarajevo when Susan Sontag did a production of it in the 1980s and 90s during the height of the Balkan Wars, where the violence had destroyed the communities, where the play says, in the midst of this void, if you wait for something outside of yourself, it won't come. And so you have to be moved to action. And then it spoke to the people of New Orleans in that moment when we did it in the Lower Ninth Ward and in Gentilly. So it can't just be a concept. So what happened from that moment was I realized that I had to do something. And so that's when I went back to my community of Pontchartrain Park, where it was that grew out of the civil rights movement. It was the one place that my father, coming back as a GI from World War II, could buy a home in segregated New Orleans. You can only go to New Orleans during segregation if you were black one day of the week on Wednesdays. And the advocacy to fight against that as an act of appeasement, this 200-acre plot was set aside for blacks, separate but equal, something ugly that we turned into something beautiful, 1,000 homes around this beautiful golf course, and it was a bucolic black Mayberry. It was at the deepest part of the flooding. So this Moses generation had fought to give me, this Joshua generation, this wonderful community that was now destroyed, and I realized that it would be blasphemous if we let it go. And so that's when I put together the Pontchartrain Park Community Development Corporation, where we rebuilt our community brick by brick, block by block, house by house, and we're back. It's the sort of thing that is reflected in a lot of the recent parts of my career. You look at something like The Wire, which will be the first line of my obituary, and I accept it and embrace it. It was really an examination of moral ambiguity, the dysfunction of our cities, of our institutions, that David Simon so perfectly captured. Last summer, it showed the importance of having a piece of art, because as the uprising happened in Baltimore, the community, the media, everyone reached out to us, because we had been examining the issues and all the variables that contributed to that dysfunction for 5 years on that show. It's being studied at universities across this country and in other countries. And it was that examination that shows you how art is not just an intangible, inanimate action. It is something that is vital to our reflection on who we are, and it's the most important thing that we do, because we decide what is of importance to us, how we are going to reflect on what our society is about, and then act on it. And so during the uprisings of Baltimore, it was a curiosity that you would reach out to the men and women that created this television show that was such a great piece of art, that it examined the very issues that caused the uprising that was happening in Baltimore.
Let's take a phone call. And Denise, calling from Washington, D.C. there. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Mr. Pierce.
Hi, Denise.
So in this conversation, it reminds me of art and recovery. It reminds me a lot of art and protest and art and the civil rights movement. And you just touched on Baltimore last year, and it makes me think of the Black Lives Movement. And I wonder, Mr. Pierce, if you could talk about why art is so important in these points of pain and the purpose it serves to unite or to give comfort, because I think so many people need it when they see things continuing to happen that make them question the place that they live, the world they live in.
Well, we should never lose the ability to be offended. And that's what I try to remind people, especially during this time of revelation, actually. What's been happening the past year and a half in America is a time of revelation. I hope that sometimes people say, well, oh, Wendell, you know, what you were saying is happening to Black men. I now actually see. Am I going to believe my lying eyes or not? I think people are starting to see that these were not conspiracy theories, that it is a reality, that there are certain people that are causing trouble when it comes to interacting with how they deal with communities of color, when they are policing. I would hope, because I played a policeman on The Wire, and as I did my research, met so many men and women who came from those communities who said the reason they became an officer. I found so many African-American officers who said, I became a member of the police department because I wanted to fight that small element in my neighborhood that didn't reflect the Miss Ann and Mr. Joe and all these wonderful people that got up every day with honor and dignity and tried to live and improve their lives and live a good life, a decent life. And that's why they became police officers. I would hope that they would be the first ones to be upset when someone would dishonor that oath and that badge that they took. And that's the silence that I would hope to be broken, that police officers rise up and say, no, I'm not going to be offended because you're attacking those actions because it was done by a police officer. I'm going to be upset because that person does not reflect what a police officer is. And so we need those voices along with Black Lives Matter movement. And the people that get caught up in the semantics are it's a smokescreen. They're disingenuous.
Like Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter.
All Lives Matter. That's implied by the very phrase, Black Lives Matter. And we all know it. And if you don't know it, you're either ignorant, naive, or you're purposely trying to divert the conversation from the reality of what's happening.
We've seen just in the last few days James Comey, the director of the FBI, and mm-hmm. Governor Cuomo here in New York have worried out loud about too much broad brush scrutiny of the police and negativity about the police in a way that is causing police officers to maybe pull back, and therefore crime is on the rise
right.
in some cities in America. They're afraid of being criticized, whatever.
They should be offended. We should be offended by those statements. You mean to tell me that your fear of being perceived as doing something improper or the actual exposed improper behavior of other people that dishonor your profession causes you to participate in dereliction of duty? You can't do your job because you might be perceived then you aren't fit to do the job.
Let's take another call. Why don't you put up line four, Lyle, in Manhattan, but originally from New Orleans. Lyle, you're on WNYC with Wendell Pierce. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, guys. Still morning time. My question is, what is your concern with the overwhelming gentrification that's going on in New Orleans in places like St. Claude, particularly around Franklin Avenue, mm-hmm. which, you know, south of where you grew up, and its relation to your ability to try to get homeowners to purchase houses back into Pontchartrain Park.
Yes.
I hear that there's a reluctance to allow people to purchase houses, and they're trying to push Section 8 people into New Orleans East, into places like Pontchartrain Park, where there used to be, you know, middle-class black people who were homeowners.
Right. Well, first of all, I give anyone who makes a decision to move back to New Orleans and to move into New Orleans the right to call themselves a New Orleanian. I would never deny anyone or say they don't love the city as much as I do, whether you've lived there for 5 minutes or 50 years. I will give you the benefit of the doubt that you love the community because you've moved there. But when it comes to the issue of gentrification, I always try to tell those New Orleanians that the people that lived here before you, don't assume they didn't know how wonderful this neighborhood was. That you are benefiting from the neglect that was placed upon the community before you. Your good fortune is by their misfortune, because the greatest crime happened where none of their homeowner policies were honored after Katrina. So they lost their livelihood. The very thing that was supposed to protect you and give you a safety net was dishonored. Most people don't know that about New Orleans, that none of the homeowner policies were honored. And so as you come in and what is considered a gentrification, I welcome economic development. I welcome improvement in the community. But we have to find a way to make sure that those that were there before are made whole. It was criminal activity to make sure when they were denied their insurance benefits. And to be pushed out because of that, that misfortune is something that we have to make a part of the solution. Now, when it comes to Pontchartrain Park, as I'm trying to rebuild, you have to remember, as I describe in the book, when I talk about the legacy of my family, when evil people plot, good people have to plan. And my grandparents and family always taught me there are those who don't have your best interests at heart. And while we are developing in Pontchartrain Park, they're putting prohibitions on us to say we can only sell to low income. We've had to turn away cash buyers, the most un-American thing you can do. Turn away cash buyers who want to come back and say, Wendell, like you, I heard you're called to action, and I want to come back and buy the house across the street from my grandmother's home. But yet they can't, because we are restricted to sell only to low income. Why? Because they're trying to get rid of all public housing in New Orleans and push people out. The Paris plan. You don't have the inner city, but you have the suburbs. And so you have to fight against that, and we're fighting against that constantly. Those are the sort of issues that you have to fight to make sure that a rising tide floats all boats, so New Orleans isn't just a tale of two cities.
I'll tell you what, most of our tweeting listeners are loving you, and here's one that says, this is the best discussion of the intersection of art, life, and politics I've heard in ages. And so I want to go from that to a caller who I don't know where she's going to go with this, but I think Tiffany in Westchester wants to ask about when art negatively affects the conversation. Tiffany, hi. You're on WNYC. When would that be? When would that happen, that art negatively affects a conversation?
Well, can you hear me? I'm in my car.
I can.
Yes, we can.
Okay. Yes.
So we are a biracial family. We have a daughter who's Ethiopian, and she recently was getting text messages from a boy. So we're white, she's black, and she was getting text messages from a boy, and he would send her nigga, nigga, nigga. And I called the parent, and I confronted them, and the parent said to me, listen, my son, and he's the boy, was white. The boy, I have two boys, they listen to this rap music. This word is thrown around all the time. It's different when it ends in an A-H than it is when it ends in an E-R. And A-H is almost a term of endearment. She actually said to me, it's as though he were saying to your daughter, I love you, I love you, I love you. And
So that's the art in question here.
The art in question is how rappers use the N-word in their music. And how it's being interpreted. Well, like with all art, there is interpretation. It is the forum where we discuss. It is the place where we declare what is our value and where it isn't our value. So it's not that it has a negative it has a negative impact, but you have the same ability to actually have a positive impact. I don't share that belief that if it's A-H to E-R, it's the same word. Of course, words have different meanings. You couldn't get a better example of that than one of my heroes, August Wilson, who actually uses that word within the same masterful plays, like Piano Lesson, where literally Boy Willie says, "Oh, nigga, you know I'll give you a watermelon," and he gets a laugh. But then the seminal moment of that play where they talk about Papa Boy Charles was sold as a baby with his mother as a nigga and a half, where people are then exposed through art to understand that while it can be casually used in its historical context, it is a slashing, gut-wrenching, evil word right in this same piece of art. So your opportunity is to take that experience that your daughter is having and explain to her the historical significance of the word and how it should never be trivialized.
And with that, Wendell Pierce, his new book is called The Wind in the Reeds. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer, WNYC. And with all the hullabaloo over the painted and costumed characters scaring the tourists on the plazas, Times Square is in the middle of the action as usual. New York Post theater columnist and PBS theater talk host Michael Riedel has a new history of the area and the theaters that draw all the tourists there in the first place. He's known for naming names and telling the offstage story the insiders would like to keep hidden. So the book is no Disneyfied version of the history. It's called Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway. And Michael Riedel joins me now. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be here, Brian. I'm here to sing some show tunes with you.
Okay. Well, you're going to burst into song? I'm not going to burst. You'll have to sing them without me.
On my own.
You credit a chorus line with changing the city.
Yeah.
Tell us why.
Well, in the late 60s and early 70s, the city was going bankrupt, and Times Square was not a place that any tourist would ever want to go to. And indeed, the Broadway world, the theater world, was in trouble. The theaters were not landmarked back then, and they were being torn down because they had more value as parking lots. The cultural tastes had changed. Rodgers and Hammerstein suddenly became what your grandmother and your grandfather wanted to hear. Everyone wanted to hear Motown and the Rolling Stones, so Broadway was antiquated. And out of nowhere, young Michael Bennett, who danced in the chorus of many Broadway shows and was a choreographer who was ambitious to become a director, he went to the great Joe Papp at the Public Theater, and he brought with him a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And he played these interviews he'd done with all of his dancer friends on Broadway. They talked about their lives, where they came from, why they wound up on Broadway. And Joe listened to it for 15 minutes and said, "Here's some money, here's a rehearsal space, go to work." And Michael created a chorus line. Now, the Schubert Organization, which was almost insolvent at that point, they brought that show up from the Public Theater. And by the way, when it opened the Public Theater, it was hotter than the Book of Mormon. Nobody could see it down there. And the Schuberts brought it uptown to Broadway. And suddenly, after many years, Broadway had a show that people all over the world wanted to see. And I remember Phil Smith, who runs the Schubert Organization now, he told me, "We thought it would run 5 years. It ran 15 years, and it lifted the entire industry."
You want to talk a little more about the Schubert Organization? Because you could say almost, as goes the Schubert Organization, so goes Broadway.
They are absolutely the most powerful entity on Broadway, founded in 1900 by three European immigrants who grew up in Syracuse, New York. They came here with nothing really, and they built the hardware of the theaters we know today. The 17 major theaters on Broadway were built by the Schubert brothers. And the last one, J.J. Schubert, you know, they were tyrants. They were horrible to work for. But they created Broadway as we know today. And the last one died in about 1963. And the company was being run into the ground then by the drunken nephew of J.J. Schubert, who he literally ran the Schubert Organization from the second floor bar at Sardi's. So he didn't have to get too far away from his drink. And there were two lawyers, Bernard Jacobs and Jerry Schoenfeld, who had worked for the Schuberts for years. And they recognized, and it was one of the great decisions, I think, made in the history of the city, and certainly in the history of Broadway, that they had to get rid of this guy and take control of the company for themselves. And they did, and they're the ones who produced A Chorus Line and brought 42nd Street in and formed the relationships with Andrew Lloyd Webber and Cameron Mackintosh, who did Cats and Les Mis, and these shows that take in billions of dollars around the world now.
So, listeners, any questions for theater critic Michael Riedel, who's now the author of Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Razzle Dazzle, song from the play Chicago.
I'm taking requests today, Brian, from your listeners.
Distract them with the sequins and nobody notices the shady stuff going on.
Nobody can see with sequins in their eyes. But, you know, one of the points I wanted to get across in the book is when you talk about reviving a city and the revitalization of New York, a lot of people talk about sports. There seems to be an obsession with sports franchises. If we just get a big basketball team or build a stadium. You know, Broadway was here for New York City when much of what used to be here was deserting it. And I believe the arts are fundamental to the success of a city. And New York has one thing that no other city in the world has, and that's Broadway.
So how much was the transformation of Times Square done by Giuliani or Disney, and how much by Michael Bennett, who created A Chorus Line?
I think you have to have something in Times Square that people want to go see that's not going to be dangerous or something shady. You needed shows to bring people back to the neighborhood. You needed A Chorus Line. You needed 42nd Street. You needed Cats to bring people in. And that's why I think these wonderful theater artists who create the craziest shows, I'm telling you, and people think Andrew Lloyd Webber is this guy who just mints money, right? Andrew Lloyd Webber could not raise money to get Cats on in London. Everybody thought he was insane. As one of his friends said, Andrew, England is a nation of dog lovers. It'll never work. He mortgaged his house to get Cats on. And another something I want to get across in the book is that the shows that sound totally strange and bizarre and wacky, that don't sound at all like they're going to work, they're the ones that make it. It's the ones that say, hey, we're going to get Julie Taymor, and we're going to get Bono and the Edge, and we're going to do Spider-Man, one of the most popular cartoon movies of all time, and it's going to be a winner. And as we know, it was an $80 million loser.
Carl Weisbrod shows up in your book, working for Mayor Koch to get rid of the sex shops in Times Square. He's now Mayor de Blasio's head of the planning commission for the whole city, and now he's chaired the commission to corral the Desnudis and Elmos. So what goes around comes around?
Yeah, Carl was a great source for the book, and he was a big ally of the Schubert Organization because before Giuliani and before Bill Bratton, the Schuberts were a lone voice. Jerry Schoenfeld was by himself practically forming the Midtown Citizens Committee and piecemeal trying to do his best to clean up Times Square. And one of his early allies was Carl Weisbrod. And it was Carl who had the idea that you needed to have what they call legitimate use properties. You need to bring things there that people want to go to see that are not shady. And the big thing that they did, which was very controversial at the time, and it's still the ugliest building in Manhattan, is the Marriott Marquis. And they tore down two great theaters, the Helen Hayes and the Morosco, to build the Marriott Marquis. And that was very contentious back then. But that was what Koch was pushing for, the Schuberts and Carl Weisbrod.
You do have Lindsay as a bad mayor for Broadway in your book, right?
Lindsay loved Broadway. I mean, he was a handsome guy. He could have been an actor. He wore a tuxedo and he came to opening nights with his friend Jackie Kennedy. And the Broadway people did like him. He just didn't do anything for Times Square. He was ineffectual. But he was fighting, as we know, so many battles back then that I think he was just overwhelmed. I mean, I used the great Vincent Canato's wonderful book, The Ungovernable City, the mayoralty of Robert Lindsay. I mean, sorry, John Lindsay. And you just see really how in peril the city was back then. And I think he was just overwhelmed.
Seth in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Seth.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Love the show.
Thanks.
Hey, so you're talking a lot about theater history, but I actually wanted to ask about a little more current Broadway politics. Last year they eliminated the sound design Tony from the awards, and I wanted to know if you thought that will ever come back or just what your thoughts on that whole situation are.
I hope it comes back. I think all the people who work technically around Broadway are artists, the sound designers and much of an artist as the directors. But, you know, the problem is The Tony Awards, I mean, they're a victim of the success in some way. They want to be so much a part of the mainstream culture. They want high ratings for CBS. They want movie stars on there. They want to show off all the big new musicals. They just want to make it entertaining, entertaining, entertaining. And they've kind of sidelined a lot of the artists who work behind the scenes in the theater. And I am not for that, and I don't think it's fair.
Kylie in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kylie.
Hi. So I had just had a question or a slight wondering. So I used to teach in the Bronx, and for a number of my students and their families, like, Broadway was not accessible because it was so expensive. And so I just wonder if your guests could talk to how maybe the theater did help revitalize New York City, but maybe how it also contributes to the class differences for people who live in New York City, because not everybody can access Broadway.
Yes, it's an excellent point, and I really find it terrifying that the top ticket price on Broadway now is about $375. Unfortunately, though, as the city has become so successful and so glamorous and a shining tourist attraction, it has priced a lot of people out. And the Broadway producers, who are capitalists, who are in it to make a buck, they do tell me, you know, as long as enough people are coming who are willing to pay those prices, we're going to sell the tickets at those prices. I mean, I hate to say it, but I've lived in Manhattan for going on 30 years now, but I have watched it become Beverly Hills. I will give you a tip, though, Kylie. When shows are very early in previews, before they've opened and before they've gotten rave reviews, if you noodle around on the internet, you can often find pretty good prices, and you might just get in on a show that becomes something that's really only for rich people. You got to do a little homework, I think, but you can get in. If you get in, if you follow the trades, if you follow my column in the New York Post, and you see there's a lot of buzz about this thing coming, the tickets, when they go on sale initially, are often much cheaper than they are later on when the show becomes famous.
Kylie, thanks for your call. Well, was Broadway ever affordable and not mainly for tourists?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I remember talking to the great Lauren Bacall many, many years ago, and she grew up a poor kid here in New York, and her friend Alex Cohn, who became a legendary Broadway producer, together they would go to see every show in the balcony for like 50 cents. I mean, Broadway had very often been a place where working class, middle class New Yorkers would go. If we even think about the opera, I mean, the Metropolitan Opera now, the prices are very expensive. But in its original days, the Met was for a lot of working class European immigrants who loved that music, and they could go, and they were a big part of the culture of this city.
And you write about how post-war suburbanization really harmed Broadway.
Yeah, well, listen, the Broadway audience has always been white and for many years predominantly Jewish. And when we had White Flight in the 60s and 70s, Broadway's audience was going. I mean, the attendance figures hit something like 7 or 8 million in 1968, and by 1972 it's down to 4 million. Broadway lost half its audience in 4 or 5 years.
John in the West Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. It's a pleasure to talk to both of you, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I couldn't let this opportunity go by without asking about the spirit, the mindset, the worldview, the personality of the New York City theater critic. Going back to Mr. Walcott, Walter Kerr,
all the greats.
Rich, John Simon. These are all famously smart people who have a sense of theater, but are just famously unlikable. And I say that with love, because I'm unlikable. And I'm unlikable, too. But well, but what is it,
I certainly have my detractors out there.
Yeah, what is it, Mr. Riedel, about the tone and the aggressiveness that comes from love and wisdom? And is that necessary to be a New York theater critic? Is there no such thing as a passive critic? Would he get eaten alive? Does he have to match the energy of Broadway?
You can't be a passive critic. What you have to be is you have to be an engaging writer. When people read you, they have to sort of laugh. They have to get a sense, a deeper understanding perhaps of what the play is about. Or if it's bad, you have to entertain them by running it down. And there's a great tradition of extremely, if I may use the word, bitchy columnists and critics on Broadway. I cover people who are egomaniacs, larger than life. They stab each other in the back. They have amazing rivalries. They have spectacular triumphs, and they have colossal failures. They're great material for me, and I try to, in my way, in the column and in the book, I try to make them as theatrical as can be, and that often means you write some sort of bitchy, snide little behind-the-scenes stories.
There's a show tune in this somewhere. I like your unlikability.
That's right.
Did this get in the way of writing the book? I mean, I think you've had a long-running beef with the long-time-ago Times theater critic Frank Rich, and I read that he did not contribute to the book. But the feathers that you've ruffled, did they interfere with gathering information for the book other players?
Well, I found when I went to people and I said, this is the book I want to write. I really want to write a book that says Broadway helped save New York. I think they were all on board for that. I was disappointed that Frank wouldn't interview me. And, you know, frankly, I was a nobody way back in the day when Frank was on the top of the heap as the most powerful drama critic. And I thought, Walter Winchell said, if you want to be a somebody in this town, throw a brick at somebody who's already up there. So I threw my brick at Frank and it helped my career. But I did get in touch with him and I said, you know, Frank, you're a player in this scene. You are the most powerful drama critic. The Times had enormous influence back then. And I really want to put all that stuff 20 years ago behind us. And I want to get your perspective on your power, your position in the theater then, and the characters I'm dealing with. And he sent me a terse email and turned me down. But he told me his second part of his memoirs are coming out. So maybe if he disagrees with whatever I said about him in my book, he can counteract it in his book.
Then we'll talk about both of you and you'll both win.
And come on, well, a literary feud. They're wonderful to have in the theater.
But were you saying, I don't even know what your feud was based on, but whatever.
I can't remember either.
Brickbats you threw at Frank Rich 20 years ago was a calculation for your career?
Pretty much. That's the Broadway columnist in me.
Michael Riedel, his New York Post column, runs on Fridays, and he co-hosts the PBS show Theater Talk.
Kiss today, goodbye, and point me toward tomorrow. I told you I'd give you a tune there, Brian.
I can't beat that, so I'm just going to sign off. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Reimagining classic tales of literature can be done from a variety of perspectives and degrees of seriousness. Everything from Longbourn, a book which imagines the servant's point of view in Jane Austen, to the book Great that reimagines the Great Gatsby in modern times with fashion blogs and paparazzi, to that instant classic of a book, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Our next guest takes the art of transformative retelling very seriously. Her themes are serious, but her book is still pretty funny. Patricia Park, the author of Jane, a contemporary retelling of Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. Remember that book? An English orphan becomes a governess to a family, falls in love with a father, and finds out his insane wife still lurks in the house. Maybe you only half remember it. Well, this time Jane is half Korean, half American, an orphan in Flushing, who works unappreciated in her strict uncle's grocery store. Desperate for a new life, she's thrilled to become an au pair, an updated version of the governess, of course, which those Bronte sisters were so fond of writing about. After an affair with the father is cut short, Jane flees off to Seoul to reconnect with family and learn the ways of modern-day Korea, realizing she must find a balance between Queens and over there, her two homes. So please welcome Patricia Park, Brooklyn-based writer and author of Jane, a novel. So nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for having me.
When did you read the original Jane Eyre? And did you love it? Did you connect with it? Did it always stay with you from being a kid?
I first read Jane Eyre when I was 12, and I was immediately struck by someone who self-describes as poor, obscure, plain, and little. She was such a departure from the beautiful Disney heroines that I was weaned on, and yet she still held her own, and then some, and that was hugely inspirational for someone, for a preteen like me.
So the title of the book is Jane, like you'd see on your email, like regarding,
yes.
Jane. The main character is Jane Ri, which is a common Korean last name.
It is, yet the spelling that I do, R-E, is quite a departure from the original Korean last name is E, just like the letter, and its most common Western perversion is Lee, L-E-E, or R-H-E-E. So Jane having this last name Ri, R-E, is kind of like a bastard among the bastardizations of this already, perverted form of the original Korean.
What made you think that a Korean-American spin on Jane Eyre would work?
I guess it's pretty audacious, right, to take on a classic and to put your own spin on it. But for me, this book really spoke to me. When I was little and I would misbehave, my mother used to say in her broken English, she'd say, Petya, you know, you act like orphan. And I never knew what that meant. You know, you either are one or you aren't. But I realized that it meant that you were acting in a disgraceful way that shamed your family. Jane Eyre, as well, you know, she's constantly thrown these epithets, wicked, mischievous, friendless. And I realized that the Victorian construct of the orphan and the Korean post-war one had many similarities. So mine kind of drew that link, and I imbued my own experiences to this novel.
Jane lives with her uncle Sang and works in the grocery store. Have they a strained? They have a strained relationship. Is there something specifically Korean about the nature of their relationship?
Sang is very much a man of his generation. You know, he's the Koreans say that he's mutuktukhae. It kind of means that he's unemotive. You know, he's stoic. When he speaks, he barks, and he utters maybe three words, and you're just supposed to read a whole world of meaning into that. So I think the nature of their relationship is very strained because Jane is someone who wants to communicate and wants to have a family connection. And Sang, though he is her deceased mother's brother, it's strained.
Is it also representative of first generation, second generation relationships, the one who is actually the immigrant and the younger one who grows up in the United States?
Yes, it is exactly that. When I was growing up in Queens, my parents and I, we never really saw things on the same level. We didn't even speak the same language culturally or just quite literally. But it was funny because when I went on a Fulbright grant to research this novel to Seoul, I found that I was then experiencing the reverse assimilation process that my parents had gone through as first generations here in New York. And I realized, you know, all of those kind of the discrimination, the cultural barriers, those were all things that they were fighting against. And I was starting only through this novel that I start to see things through their eyes.
In the book, you allude to a Korean idea of nunchi. Am I saying that right?
Nunchi, yeah. Oh, very close. Yeah, nunchi.
Can you describe it?
Sure. I mean, it's untranslatable in English, but it's kind of anticipation and foresight. So it's this ability to walk into a room, read the situation, and anticipate not only how you're supposed to behave, but everyone else. My protagonist, Jane, has a friend who goes to MIT, who's super into sci-fi. Her name is Eunice, and she describes Nunchi as this kind of the eye of Sauron, this all-knowing stink eye that's roving about and trying to kind of catch in on all of your social missteps. It's almost kind of like a Foucauldian panopticon in that way, just this surveillance. You know, it's knowing how to pour your elder's glass of water before you pour your own. So it's a very strict code of behavior.
In the original Jane Eyre, the wife of Mr. Rochester, Bertha, has gone mad. She's violent. She lights fires. She growls. She walks on all fours. In your book, Bertha, the wife of Ed, is not quite so crazy. She's more of an insufferable academic. Can you describe coming up with her character?
That is insufferable academics. I mean, that is its own form of madness, huh? I mean, I'll be honest. I was playing, poking some gentle fun at academia in my time teaching at the college level, too. Sometimes you'd come across these quote-unquote insufferable types. But I think what's interesting about this archetype of the madwoman in the attic, which is very problematic, especially when we're viewing it from, say, a male's point of view or a 19th century society's point of view, I think what happens in Re Jane is that Jane herself views the Bertha Mason character as mad, again, in quotes, and it's only after she accrues different life experiences that she comes to see Beth in a more kind of sympathetic light and begins to read her differently.
Why did you choose to have Jane enter a world of Brooklyn academics?
I think, it draws from my own experiences. My parents have a grocery store in Carroll Gardens, and I saw that neighborhood change from when I was a little kid, when it was very much moonstruck territory, all Italians, and then seeing slowly this kind of the gentrification of the neighborhood. And also, I mean, you know, I'm from the outer boroughs. I went to Bronx Science, and then I went to Swarthmore for undergrad, and I was suddenly entering this world where I felt like everyone was speaking a foreign language. I didn't speak academic ease. I don't even know if that's what you call it, but I had to learn quick.
My guest is Patricia Park, author of the new novel, Re Jane. We just have a few minutes, but I wonder if anybody is listening right now and thinking, oh my God, this is me. Call us up or anyone else with a question, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Any Korean Americans in the audience relating to any particular part of this might want to tell a 30-second version of your own story or ask Patricia Park a quick question, 212-433-9692. But call right up because we only have about 3 or 4 minutes. So in the book, Jane flees to Korea to escape Ed and Beth, but also goes because her grandfather had died. You also had an experience returning to Korea. So there's a whole other part of the second generation experience. You go back to the country of origin of your parents and what? You get disillusioned?
Well, it's interesting that you use the word returning because right up until the moment that I went, I was also using.
From here, I mean.
Yeah, and it calls into question, you know, where is the motherland? Where do you belong to or from? And I was using that very rhetoric as well. I'm returning to Korea. Oh, I'm going back. And I went there, and gosh, for one, I sounded like a 65-year-old fuddy-duddy. I was using words like outhouse or apothecary because my knowledge of modern Korean society was so distanced, despite the fact that I lived very much in the Korean community in Queens.
Excuse me, I have to go to the outhouse?
That was exactly what I would say. And people would stare at me. They're like, first off, I would bow to every single cashier, barista, waiter that I met because that's what you did in Flushing. Needless to say, there was a lot of culture shock.
Let's get Emma in Manhattan in here who's familiar with a Japanese book that was based on Wuthering Heights. Is that right, Emma?
Anna, yes. It's called A True Novel by Minai Mizumura, and it's about a girl growing up in Great Neck, and the Heathcliff character is a chauffeur who has been, no one really knows his parentage, he's part Chinese, and he becomes this tremendous mogul. And always in love with the little girl in whose household he was taken care of.
Good parallel, good tip. I'm going to sneak Lisa in New Hyde Park in here in our last 30 seconds. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, how are you?
Good. You're relating to this?
Yes, very much so. I grew up in Levittown, New York, and my dad was an immigrant from France, and most of our neighbors were from Italy, France. You know, we've been talking about this just recently, and it's very much the same experience, very much. And so I love what she's done with the book, and all the best.
Thank you so much. I'm so heartened to see that there are parallels. Thank you.
So you don't have to be Korean.
I should hope not. I mean, you know, novelists, they reach the universal through the specific.
And that's what Patricia Park is trying to do with her new novel, Re-Jane, a contemporary retelling of Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, set in Korean America and Flushing. So nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. In 2006, Elizabeth Gilbert's memoir, Eat, Pray, Love, sold 10 million copies and inspired millions of people, women especially, to seek their own happiness through travel, among other means. Her new book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, seeks to inspire readers without having you have to leave home, instead helping you to stay put and produce your own creative work. She is also the author of novels, including The Signature of All Things, which I read last summer right after Elizabeth was here, and I loved it so much. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions about Signature later.
I'm happy to talk about it.
But welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's wonderful to be back.
Why magic, big magic? It's so mystical when talking about human creativity.
Because I think human creativity is kind of touched with the mystical. And although we do live in a post-enlightenment, post age of industrialization, scientific world, and I'm happy that we do. I think that creativity is probably the only realm of the human experience in which I think it's perfectly safe and actually probably better to keep open a channel for mysticism, magic, and mystery.
And you seem to think that ideas themselves have a certain amount of agency. You're right. When an idea thinks it's found somebody who can bring it into the world, the idea will pay you a visit. It will try to get your attention, mostly when you will not notice. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. The reason I describe it that way is because that's what it feels like. And it's not just that that's what it feels like for me, that when inspiration comes, it feels like it's a visitation, that this idea has come from an external source. It's how creative people across the millennia have described it. And even really rational people, you'll hear them say things like, then the idea came to me. You know, it does feel, we've all had that experience where it feels like something was kind of implanted in you. And my experience with that is that those moments are invitations, where an idea is sort of going around the world, tapping on people's shoulders saying, are you my mother? Are you my mother? Are you my mother? And when it finds someone who wants to collaborate with you, you know, with it to make it manifest, all it wants is for you to say yes. But mostly we say no.
I want people to know that you're the host of a podcast based on ideas from this book called Magic Lessons, where you take calls from people who want to create but are creatively blocked.
Yeah.
And I'm going to play a clip from your first episode of Magic Lessons. This is Erin Rawlings, a blogger with a desire to write, talking about that desire and figuring out what's keeping her from realizing it.
There is just like this gnawing feeling, I would say, starting this December, after 3 months of adjustment of having both kids in school full time, there was just like this undercurrent of this need to write, but like I just couldn't figure out how to make it work. And I got really quiet with myself, like twice a week at yoga. I realized that I think the core of my struggle is guilt.
And a lot of your book is about the connection between things like guilt and fear and creativity.
Yeah, and shame. I mean, this is particularly an issue for women, and this book is very much intentionally directed toward women and toward women who are not professional creators, you know, but toward women who are living their lives in what we might call more regular ways. But, you know, they are the ones who have often been left out of conversations about creativity in a world where we fetishize professionalism and passion and the special and the entitled and the trained. There are a lot of people out there who are brimming with ideas, but they feel like this doesn't belong to me. Or if I indulge in this and it feels like indulgence, I'll be taking something away from my family. I won't be producing. I can't do ART because I got a J-O-B. You know, all of these sort of things that keep people from accessing, I think, an incredibly potent force that might actually bring them into a fuller sense of being.
So, listeners, are you a creative person? Are you creatively blocked or blocked out of fear or guilt or shame or any of the things that Elizabeth Gilbert has just been talking about and want advice? We can do a little of that here, like on her podcast, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're in New York and New Jersey, public radio. And I love your pages on the paradox of creativity as totally essential and totally not.
Right.
And you cite a short clip from 30 Rock in which Jack berates Liz for being a mere writer, and this being radio, we can hear the clip.
In a post-apocalyptic world, how would society even use you?
Traveling bard.
Radiation canary.
So, Alec, feel free to call in and talk about delivering that line.
I love that moment so much.
To Liz Gilbert, not Liz Lemon, but why do you love that line?
I love that line because I think it's true. You know, that sometimes, especially artists who take themselves very seriously, will allow themselves to think that that their creativity is the most important thing in the world, when really, of course, the world has a great deal more pressing material problems to deal with than your painting or your play or your poem. So the thing that makes me continue to do the work, though, without having an existential crisis about how unimportant it is that I'm writing a novel, is to say it's important to me. You know, so you don't put your work out in the world thinking society needs this, human beings need this. You put the work out in the world because if you keep it inside you, it will harm you. I had a conversation with my friend Brené Brown about this recently, and she had a great line where she said, unused creativity is not benign. Creativity is an amazingly powerful force, and if you don't find some sort of outlet for it, it doesn't just sit there in neutral.
Huh.
It actually, you know, I always say
becomes
having...
sort of spiritually malignant and turns against
it
you.
It metastasizes. And, you know, the other way to say it is what I say in the book, that having a creative mind, which is to say a human mind, is like owning a border collie for a pet. You must give it something to do or it will find something to do. And what it may find to do, if you don't give it an outlet, is to turn against you.
So if Eat, Pray, Love was creativity and travel, and Big Magic is creativity, stay in place, there's a dichotomy between travel and writing, right? I mean, the road trip motif is about travel, but writing requires you to stay still, to stay put in one place and use a computer or a notebook.
Yeah, it makes you have to have that wonderful Yiddish word sitzfleisch, which means the flesh on your butt. You have to have enough butt flesh to be able to sit in one place. Restless people like me sometimes have trouble with that part of it. But you know, the other part of writing for me is about going out in the world and rolling around in ideas and trying things out and traveling and learning stuff and having it stick to you. And then you bring it all back and sit on your butt and do the work.
And so looking at this book made me think of your novel, Signature of All Things, in a different light. I said I read it, you know, after you were here last time. I absolutely loved it. And I loved your character, Alma, who became creative in place growing up, almost totally homebound, and then became more creative and almost an enlightened being through travel. So this stay at home versus travel is a dynamic you must have been thinking about forever.
Yeah, because, you know, it's so funny. When I initially sat down to write that novel, I wanted it to be the antithesis of Eat, Pray, Love. And so I wanted to create a woman who had no options to explore the world and who had to discover her creativity and her passion and her power within the confines of her father's home, essentially. And the first 300 pages of that book are that. And then, honestly, I got to a point where I just said, I just can't do this anymore. And I put her on a boat and I sent her to Tahiti because that's just me imposing myself on the story. It was
so interesting. So
I physically couldn't keep her there.
You didn't have – Joyce Carol Oates was here one time and she said, I know what my beginning, middle, and end are going to be, and
yeah,
then I write the book. And I was shocked when Alma – left to travel the world in that book. And it sounds like you only discovered that plot twist as you were writing.
If you were shocked, imagine my surprise. You know, I think there are writers who are, you know, Nabokov had that great line. Somebody said to him, do your characters ever take you by surprise? And he said, my characters are galley slaves. You know, like there are certain authors who I think really do just keep a whip on their characters. And for me, I feel like I have a pretty good idea where it's going, but if they start telling me different, I'm not going to argue. Alma wanted to get on a boat. She got on a boat.
Elizabeth Gilbert, author of Eat, Pray, Love, her new book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, and Bruce in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. You know, so much has been written about how talent is overrated, how there's no substitute for hard work and labor in the creative expression to great success in creative expression. But I find myself very attached to laziness because I equate it with tranquility and peacefulness and all the Zen things. So I really would rather do as little work as possible and create as much as possible. Is that wrong, or is there a way to overcome that?
Well, is all that you write little haikus?
Cohen's.
Or what? Yeah.
Well, I'll never forget, Truman Capote once said he would spend, I think it was on an episode of Laugh-In, they said, you spent a week writing one word, and he said, yes, but it was the right word.
Oh, my goodness.
So I kind of, I guess I take forever to write.
Miles David said he would give up all his long solos if he could find that one perfect note.
Robert Stone, the late great novelist, had a terrific line where he said, I have the two worst qualities possible for a writer. I'm lazy and I'm a perfectionist. If that's working for you, sir, awesome. I mean, you know, really what I'm presenting in this book is just what works for me, and if it doesn't serve anyone else, then, you know, as you were. But the ethos that I try to live by is the opposite of lazy perfectionism. It's, you know, I call myself the world's most disciplined half-ass. I think it's about, you know, putting in the hours and working really hard. And then the only way I've ever been able to release 7 books into the world is that at each point, in each book, there was a moment where I just said, it's good enough.
And you've got all these almost competing quotes like Wordsworth, said poetry is a spontaneous overflow. And poet Jack Spicer says quite literally that writing comes from extraterrestrial forces, aliens from outer or other space. But then Picasso, inspiration exists, but it has to find you working. I guess I'm more from that camp. 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration.
Somebody said to me the other day, wait, I don't understand, because half of this book is all about real pragmatism and the other half is about kind of mysticism. And somebody said, so I don't get it. Do you believe in hard work or do you believe in magic? And the answer is a very firm yes.
Yes. Maya in Chicago, you're on WNYC with Elizabeth Gilbert. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you. This show just is really sparking a lot of thoughts in my head, guilt, fear, passion. And I have a skin disorder, and I'm almost 50. I put it on hold writing this book. I said I was going to do 10 chapters. I'm not a professional writer. I just have a lot to share about my skin disorder. But then I saw this top model had the same thing, and she was all over the map. And I'm like, well, forget it then. You know, who wants to hear my story?
So your thing is it's all been done. What you want to do has been done already, right? Is that the anxiety?
Yeah, it's been done already. But the thing is, it hasn't been said or done by me.
There you go.
Even though she's 25 years younger and, you know, she has this and that. And I thought, man, it would be awesome if I could do an interview where I'm an older, youthful person and she's young and she's all over the map. And we could have an interview and talk about it. But then it was just my other self saying, there you go. Get out of writing your book. Find a cheaper way to do it.
You know,
I
think one of the things that really causes people a lot of anxiety when it comes to sitting down and trying to be creative is the sense that everything has already been done, or very specifically the thing that you want to do has already been done. And this is why I advocate whenever I have a chance to talk about it, I'm pro authenticity. I'm anti originality, because I think when you're trying to be original, that's virtually impossible. Because essentially everything has been done already. Every story that can be told has been told. Shakespeare was borrowing stories 500 years ago. It hasn't stopped, you know, 500 more years of people taking the same ones and retelling them. Do it from your authentic self. Do it because it ignites your life. Do it because it sets your head on fire, and leave the rest of it alone.
Maya, thank you. And Sarah in Brooklyn, I think, is calling to say that she feels guilt in the creative process. Sarah, hi.
Hi. I'd just like to hear you speak more on that subject. It's something I experience really regularly, and I don't hear people talk about it very much, but I think it's universal. And I'm a painter and formerly a photographer, and it's just, anyway, sort of like trying to find a way to channel the guilt to my advantage or abandon it altogether.
Yeah, it's such, you know, I think sometimes there's a wonderful line by the British poet David White, who said that in order to be any kind of a creator at all, a person must summon what he called the arrogance of belonging. And the word that I keep using is entitlement. And, you know, look, you're a good person. I'm a good person. We're all good people. None of us want to be entitled. None of us want to be Kim and Kanye, right? Like, that's a word that we all sort of hate right now. And yet, there is no way to become a creator without standing in a certain degree of entitlement that says, I am a creature of creation. I am a child of God. I am a participant in this culture. I have a voice. I have a vision, wonky as it may be, and I want to leave a bit of a thumbprint in the world. And, you know, the arrogance of belonging isn't standing up on a table and saying, I'm the greatest. It's standing firmly in your own two bare feet and saying, I'm here. And I don't want to just be here to pay bills and die. I'm not just a meat puppet made to produce for a capitalistic society. I'm not just here, you know, to be a list of my obligations and to efficiently get done everything people expect me to get done in the world. I also want to spend a little bit of time exploring the best part of my humanity, which is the completely irrational voice that says, I want to make something no one needs. And if you can't do a little of that in your life, what in the world are we even doing here?
Sarah, thank you. Elizabeth Gilbert's new book is Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. Thanks again for coming in.
Always a pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And if you recognize that music, you will know that my next guest is one-third of Sleater-Kinney, a band that, as she puts it, was either loved or hated with little universal appeal. The band formed in the mid-90s in Olympia, Washington, where the Riot Girl scene was flourishing, broke up in 2006, and recently got back together and released what I think we can safely call a much-loved album earlier this year. Carrie Brownstein is a guitarist and singer in the band Slater Kinney and Wild Flag, an actor you might know from the TV show Portlandia and Amazon's Transparent, a writer who, by the way, wrote for an NPR music blog for a few years and who is now the author of a new memoir called Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. Hi, Carrie Brownstein. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
The memoir is focused on your childhood, I see, and the years when Slater Kinney was a band before it first broke up in the 90s and early 2000s. It barely gets to Portlandia and your other current projects. Are you hoping to take your newer fans who may know you from your more recent work for a walk through your past?
I suppose. I felt like the story of Slater Kinney was a better container for the themes of the book, which basically encompass sort of a journey from feeling kind of on the margins, a little bit lost, a tumultuous childhood, into a community and a world where I felt seen and felt a sense of belonging. And the creative endeavor of Slater Kinney was kind of a better metaphor for that. Portlandia, I should say, is very much in the subtext of this book. There is a lot of incidents that one can see the seeds of Portlandia.
Because of this kind of politically correct culture in Olympia?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it political correctness. I think a lot of it had to do with that kind of confounding nexus where something that espouses inclusion ends up feeling very elitist and exclusive, you know, where you sort of substitute one dogma for another, and there's a lot of inherent contradictions. You're sort of trying to follow these rules, and they seem very cumbersome and very contrarian, and you know, it starts to feel a little absurd, and Portlandia definitely stems from that. As much as I loved and needed that at the time, you know, eventually I started to see a little bit of humor in it.
And you describe Olympia, Washington as a very earnest place where there was a moral code that you adhered to if you wanted to belong to the music scene. Can you give us an example of that?
Well, you know, it's a term that I think is very foreign to people now, but this idea of selling out, that one could, you know, that once art was married with commercialism, that it would be devalued, that it would become inherently vapid, the commodification of it.
Can happen.
Yeah. We know would sort of suck all of, you know, the intention and value out of it. So that was a hard line, and there was a Rubicon you really could not cross then without being met with derision and repulsion and rejection from many fans. And that, you know, we sort of grew up in kind of indoctrinated into this kind of anti-capitalist, anti-corporate indie rock at the time. And so if you had ambition, if you wanted to reach people where you weren't just preaching to the choir, you know, there was some skepticism there. It was kind of anathema to the codes we are, you know, trying to live by.
And so Portlandia, for a progressive viewership, is kind of the ability to make fun of ourselves in a way, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, one reason I think people are drawn to Portlandia, feel a sense of kinship and ownership with it, is because it's kind-hearted, for one, and we are those people that are kind of exploring this relationship to couplehood, to community, to our neighborhoods, the ways we've curated our lives and our both our on-screen lives and our real lives to a way that really serves our special needs, and starting to wonder, is this really what's important? Are we doing better now, or is this actually kind of silly?
Carrie Brownstein with us on WNYC. Her new memoir is called Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. And in the early part of it, focused on your childhood and the years, as I said, when Slater Kinney was first a band. Starting in your childhood, where you kind of matter-of-factly report your childhood troubles. Your mom struggled with anorexia. Terry Gross went into great detail about that with you. And she eventually left the family, your mom. Your dad came out to you as gay when you were a young adult, and he was 55. And then there's the band, which I guess in many ways became your family. Is that an apt way to put it?
Yeah. You know, I think when you grow up in a chaotic household where you don't feel seen, you don't feel recognized, and there's an unsteadiness there. wherein you can't latch on to anything that feels certain and feels solid, you look for substitution. You look for a way of transferring the idea of family from the nuclear family to a group of people that will hopefully understand you and be able to kind of embrace you unconditionally. So Slater Kinney certainly became that salvation. I think the music community in general, first in Olympia and then in Portland, was definitely my family.
Do you think it matters to the music how much a band bonds personally?
Yeah, I think there's a real, bands are kind of a unique thing. They're different from a solo artist that plays with, a bunch of very, very talented session musicians or kind of cobbles together a touring act. Bands are very familial. There's that volatility. There's inherent friction, usually an overarching love and affection. But I think often, especially a trio, there's always an imbalance. And I think that ability to kind of be clumsy at moments and then have to right yourself makes for some very galvanic music, because you're always on the brink of toppling.
And you write a lot about how performing on stage gave you validation. Near the end, when you're recounting the first show Slater Kinney played after reuniting earlier this year, you described the crowd's welcome as something, quote, so enormous I could climb inside. Can you tell us more about that feeling of performing when it's going well?
It's a real ineffable thing and often difficult to explain. But so much of performing to me is about dissipating a sense of distance, to cohere a divided self, to be in a room with people and feel a sense of communion, to have a moment of shared collective wonder. And I think when you're able to harness something that is grand with a group of people and know that it has never happened before and will never happen again, to be able to even enjoy that moment for a second, I think changes you.
How different does it feel to perform music on stage compared to acting?
Well, the live audience really changes things. I mean, audiences are performing as well. They're performing a role as an audience, individually and as a whole.
They just don't know it.
Some of them do, and some of them don't. But they're definitely part of the performance and play their roles. And again, there's a lot of spontaneity. Acting on Portlandia, which involves a lot of improvisation, is more analogous sometimes to a live performance, although you can't rely on that instant gratification. Sometimes when Fred and I do something and the crew laughs, we just think, nope, that worked in the room. That doesn't necessarily serve the story.
Have you done theater on stage?
I did in high school, and I really enjoy live performing a lot.
There's a great story in the book of a show that you played at Oberlin around 2000, where the White Stripes opened for Slater Kinney just before they blew up, and what happened after the show was kind of humbling, right? Can you tell us that story and what it says about the touring musician's life?
Sure. There's often a vast disparity between what people are imagining your touring life to be, which, in the most sort of debauched way involves groupies and drugs. And I should add, none of those things existed for my band. So we're with the White Stripes before they blew up. They're opening for us. We play a cafeteria, which you're basically playing over somebody announcing over an intercom, Mike, your pizza's ready. If you're not loud enough, Mike, your pizza's ready is basically the chorus of your song. So we finished this already very humbling experience, and we go to an after party thinking, hey, we're in a college town. And we get there, and these two guys come out, and they just say, who are you? We're with Jack and Meg White and me and my bandmates, and they're like, yeah, you're not welcome at this party. And I just thought, we're the band. But nope, not at Oberlin. Bastion of liberalism. They were like, no, we do not party with musicians.
And for people who want to get their bubble burst, the book is full of stories about just how unglamorous touring is, from having to constantly, as you put it, recalibrate what constitutes home and stability and how hard it is to maintain a relationship, to the long van rides, to just being stuck with the same small group of people for weeks on end. You wrote in a journal entry that, quote, the end of tour, it's almost like waking up in the hospital after an accident. Slowly you take stock of the damage, a cut, a scrape. Maybe you discover a part that no longer functions properly, unquote. But the payoff is that you get to perform and make a living. Is it worth it?
It is worth it, and I never take it for granted. And I'm always flummoxed by anyone that gets onto stage and has the opportunity to perform in front of people and doesn't give everything, doesn't leave it all there, doesn't see it as a privilege, because I certainly do. And you live for that moment at the end of the long, monotonous day.
Is it also more necessary in current music economics if it's harder to sell either individual songs as downloads or CDs, which hardly anybody is buying anymore, and people get their music for free so much, and then you have to make all your money by touring? Is that kind of the way it is?
That's absolutely the way it is, and I think the hardest working musicians are on the road much of the year. Once they put an album out, the cycle is usually about 2 years to really promote the album in order to make a living. You can augment that through licensing and other means, but all along however it's stratified, all those musicians are touring.
Are you indignant about that, resentful about that? Like an older generation of musicians could have supported themselves mostly on album sales?
I'm absolutely not indignant about it. I think the live performance is the part of creating music that is, to me, the most vital. It's the most rewarding, and it's the most unique.
When you look back on the early days of Slater Kinney and the scene in Olympia, some of your descriptions are pretty funny, like when the band was having some trouble with an early member and you decided to hire a mediator. But instead of a professional, you hired, quote, a dyed black-haired metal music fan named Stacy DC. In hindsight, perhaps we should have paid for a legitimate interlocutor. Were these just normal growing pains for the band?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, everyone back then had a moniker like that, you know, some kind of play on words like Stacy DC. It's just like, anyway, I don't know why we would think that this person, completely unqualified to mediate a dispute between Corn and I and an earlier bandmate. And, you know, we just sat around in a park and talked about things, and I think felt worse afterwards, and probably affected my relationship with the band AC/DC as well.
And when Slater Kinney first took, you mean just because of the name?
Yeah, I'm just kidding.
when Slater Kinney first took some time off, you wrote that you weren't sure who you were without the band. The band is back together now, but are you at a place now where your sense of self exists with and without Slater Kinney?
Absolutely. I mean, I think as we talked about earlier, you know, I had really sort of merged myself with the band as a sense of salvation and seeking of wholeness. And when that went on hold, you know, I had to kind of figure out who I was apart from that, which I think is an important part of growing up in a journey where you realize, well, I don't want to be valued and judged by what I do, but who I am. So I think that was kind of a good step towards that realization. And now I feel certain that, you know, the things that I want to be known for are kindness and compassion and how I treat the people that I love more than, you know, what my jobs are.
But in a way, the band members, even though they're from, quote, your job, will still feel like your family always?
I hope so, yeah.
How much do you enjoy Portlandia or Transparent?
I enjoy both of them immensely. I feel so lucky to get to do Portlandia with Fred Armisen. Again, it's allowed a levity, a way of viewing the world through absurdism, which I think in some ways is the most logical way of dealing with, you know, some of the woes of the world is to try to process them through something that allows for a gray area, allows for exploration. And then Transparent, putting my faith in the perspicacity of someone like Jill Soloway is wonderful. Great writers on that show.
You want to talk a little bit about that for people who haven't figured out yet that you can watch television on Amazon?
Yes, let me explain Amazon.com to you. Transparent is a wonderful show that I feel lucky to be a part of, that is a beautiful story that is essentially about a family. Happens that the father of the family is in the first season transitions and is in the process of transitioning and is a transgender woman. And to me, that is both a crucial element of the story and also beside the point, because it's a story about families, about selfishness, about discovery, about human fragility and faults. And it's just a beautiful, dark comedy that I love and feel very proud to be a part of.
So you've got a lot going on. TV, the band, book tour.
A book tour, which I'm on now.
So congratulations on the book, and thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Thanks for having me on.
As we leave it there for today, my guest has been Carrie Brownstein, guitarist and singer in the band Slater Kinney, Kinney and Wild Flag, an actor you might know from Portlandia, and Transparent, a writer who, by the way, wrote for an NPR music blog for a few years and who is now the author of a new memoir, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. Carrie Brownstein, thanks again.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. More to come. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer, WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and earlier this summer, President Obama unveiled a new plan to combat climate change and reduce human impact on the environment. On the other side of the globe, the Fulani people of West Africa are already feeling the effects of climate change on their lifestyle. Out of the 40 million nomads left in the world, more than half of them are Fulani. Journalist Anna Bodkin spent a year journeying with a Fulani family, learning about their culture, religion, the threats to their way of life, and why they may be more susceptible than many others to be lured in by jihadi groups. She chronicles her travels in the new book, Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. Anna, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
What's a nomad in 2015? What does the word actually mean today?
Well, the nomad is somebody who follows cattle in 2015 or 10,000 years ago when the first nomads began to traverse the earth. And today's nomads are cattle herders of the Sahel, or reindeer herders in Alaska. Maybe some shepherds in Anatolia are nomads. I spent a year working with, living with, and herding cattle, herding cows with nomadic Fulani cowboys in the Sahel.
What was that like for you? Where did you grow up? How different was that for you?
Oh, I grew up in the Global South, but I grew up in the Soviet Union, so my Global South was very far north at the 60th parallel. When I tried to describe what it was like to grow up in snow to my hosts, they laughed at me. They couldn't believe that such a thing is possible. They said, "What do the cows eat?"
So with more than 20 million members, the Fulani, you tell us, are the largest remaining group of nomads in the world. What got you interested in traveling with the Fulani? What were you really looking for?
I'm interested in all of my work in exploring other ways of looking at the world, a different vantage point of experiencing our planet and experiencing life. And I thought, what is it like to experience life at 3 miles an hour with people who have been walking always? I mean, we're talking about a group that has been walking for a living for the last 10,000 years. So what is it like? What is the world like to them? And what is it like to be with them in these huge open spaces for which our bodies and our minds have evolved? What is it like to see the world with them and maybe through their eyes?
And so you write that you cooked over a manure fire and slept next to a goat during your migratory trip between summer and winter pastures. You went on this trip with the Fulani for the book. And listeners, do you have a question about the Fulani people? Do you want to know more about Anna Botkin's journey? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And I do want to relate this to some of the contemporary issues that we deal with in this country, because you do in the book link it to climate change and jihadi terrorism. Why would a nomad people like the Fulani be more susceptible to the effects of climate change than anyone else?
Because they have absolutely no social security structure to fall back on. Everything they have is their cattle, and their cattle is dependent on the presence of pasture. Now, with the crises, the droughts that are becoming systemic in sub-Saharan Africa, the pastures are dwindling, and so there is less grazing land for the cows, and so the cows are dying, and if the cows are dying, then the Fulani have nothing to eat. It's very simple. It's almost simplistic, and it's tragically simple.
It's the expansion of the desert, desertification.
Absolutely.
You write that jihadists are also another major challenge to the Fulanis. Is it that they're being recruited by the jihadis, or they're being attacked by the jihadis?
Both. Some Fulani join the jihad because they're very popular marabu, very popular religious leaders who encourage young Fulani men to take back grazing lands that they believe belong to them. And of course, some Fulani have to reroute their journeys that have been finessed by millennia of traveling because of the jihad, because there is a war now where their pastures used to be.
So there's a relationship between climate change and the increase in jihadists in the region?
Yes, it is believed very widely that there is a very strong link between the loss of resource and religiously motivated wars, because, of course, all wars are territorial wars, and the access to an increasing amount of disempowered people, this is what any terrorist group feeds on.
212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, to talk to journalist Anna Botkin, who's here with her new book, Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. And Noor in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, hello, Brian. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
Okay, my question for your host is, okay, I'm from the Guarani nomad tribe, which is the northern part of Chad, southern of Libya. And we've been, like, in touch with the Fulani for so long now, it's been forever. We want to know, what is the origin of Fulani? Which part of Africa they really belong to?
Why would that matter, Noor? I'm just curious what you're trying to solve for yourself here.
I'm Guarani, and then the northern part of Chad been our home for the past 2,000-3,000 years. Wherever you go, to any country in like sub-Saharan African country, you will always see Fulani. So I want to know to which group of to which country they really belong, how their journey start, why they become the largest nomad tribe in all African country. Like, I really want to know what are their origins and which part of Africa they belong, and why after 10,000 years they're still the biggest nomad tribe in Africa.
Okay, you've drawn a big smile from our guest, by the way. So Anna, what do you have to say to Noor?
Well, the origin of the Fulani people is also the origin of my people and Brian's people. It's believed to be Ethiopia. We all came from Ethiopia. Fulani do not belong specifically. There is no Fulani country. As you probably know, Fulani live across the Sahel in about 20 countries, and they're a minority in each of them. They don't have a state of their own, which makes sense for a nomadic people, that there would be no borders.
So they're stateless people. They're not registered with the government of any country in many cases, right?
Very often, because governments being organizations that believe in control and borders traditionally dislike people who are hard to control and borderless.
And that's, there's tension, as you tell it, between the Fulani nomads and the sedentary people of Mali in particular?
That's the old Cain and Abel tension, right? Cain was a farmer and Abel was a herder, and they didn't like each other, and they still don't.
Hence the title of your book, Walking with Abel.
Correct.
George in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Thank you very much. Fulanis are major tribes in West Africa. They are called different names in different countries. Fulanis are in Nigeria. They are major tribe in Nigeria in the military. They are major tribe in Ghana. They are major tribe in Mali. They are major tribe in Senegal. Fulanis are all over West Africa.
George, thank you very much. Anabat, can you write that in the case of the Fulani, history doesn't repeat itself, it parodies. What do you mean by that?
In the 19th century, a trilingual Fulani poet named Uthman Danvojo launched a jihad to bring Islam or purify Islam in West African heartlands. He came with fighters on camelback and horseback and delivered a jihad on the tips of spears to what today is Mali, among other places. And one of his disciples became a very prominent sheikh who created the Masina Empire, Fulani Empire, in today's central Mali. One of the things that sheikh did, his name was Sheikh Amadou, he destroyed or let fall into disrepair old mosques and old religious monuments that he believed to be too ostentatious and un-Islamic. Today's jihadis in Mali are doing the same thing, as most of our listeners probably know, destroying ancient monuments. And very recently, somebody had tried to blow up a very small and rather unpretentious mausoleum in Mali, and that mausoleum actually is the grave of Sekou Amadou.
Mm. Here is a Fulani caller from Manhattan. Mamadou, you're on WNYC. Hello, Mamadou.
Hello, hi. Thanks for taking me. I like the show. What your guest is saying concerning Fulani about being nomad, so That was a true, I would say, centuries ago. But nowadays, in my country, businesses are held by Fulani, so we're not doing that kind of job anymore. And so I will say we are even 5% following cows now. Because, as I said, my grandfather was born in 1915, so he doesn't know anything about cow. He was a guy living in the city. He passed away in Dakar. My father himself doesn't know anything about cow, so I myself, I cannot get close to a cow, thinking that the cow can do harm to me.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take job that Fulani people do today, businesses in West Africa, I would say 80% are held by Fulani. Fulanis have become traders; they have become business people.
Mamadou, thank you. Fulanis have become traders. Fulanis have become business people.
Yes, Tiabasane Mamadou, thank you for joining us. Absolutely. And moreover, demographic experts predict that within 100 years, all people on the planet will be settled and living in cities. The farther the planet changes, the more centered, the more metropolitan areas expand, the harder it is, of course, to maintain the kind of lifestyle, the traditional kind of lifestyle that, as Mamadou pointed out, most Fulani experienced 300 years ago and few continue to maintain today. When I brought this up to my hosts, they paused and they said, in cities, where will we keep our cows?
Mm. We have three more Fulani callers waiting on the line.
Bismillah.
We have time to take one more of them. And let's see. Who should we make it? Well, let's make it Ba in Manhattan. Yeah. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Brown. I'm very, very happy to have this segment. I'm Fulani. I'm from Guinea, West Africa. Over there, we have a majority tribe. We are 40% of the population. And since the 18th century, since 1760, we are no more nomad. We have our empire, the Fouta Djallon, in Guinea. If you go to Senegal, you will find also the Fouta Toro. If you go to Mali, you will find the Massina Empire. That's we are no more nomad. We are exactly like all other peoples, and we live in a specific area. Mm-hmm. I think the lady, she lives with those we call Bororo. Bororo means Fulani from the bush.
Correct.
They live in the bush, the Bororo people. I lived with them in Niamey, in Birningaure, what we call W Park in Niger. I know them very well. I'm Fulani, I speak Fulani. So it's no more true that we are nomad, first of all.
Thank you, and I'm going to leave that there as the last thought. I could listen to him all day. But you chose to follow, for your book, those Fulani who are still
the Bororo
nomads.
Ladenke Fulani, yes.
Because you find that lifestyle so, what, rare in this world anymore, and threatened? Is this about trying to preserve the possibility of nomad life? The Fulani who were calling in seem to make it sound like, hey, we don't do that anymore. We're in the modern world now. You know, maybe they don't care that much if the nomadic lifestyle persists.
No, not really, Brian. It's more about experiencing the world in a different way than people in the global north are familiar with. So it's not an attempt to exoticize a lifestyle that is vanishing. It's not an attempt to even immortalize in a way or stop time a little bit. It's just a way of experiencing the world from a different vantage point and describing what is it like to be constantly leaving? What is it like to be constantly arriving philosophically, psychologically? What is it like to be on the hoof all the time? And there, while most people are indeed settling, there still are a lot of people, about 40 million people in the world, who still are doing this one way or another.
We have nomads in New York, too, you know, people who get kicked out of their apartments over and over again by gentrification and have to follow affordable housing from borough to borough to borough.
Exactly.
But that's another story. So we will leave it there. Anna Botkin, the book is called Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. So fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all our callers. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, wnyc.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Brian Lehrer, WNYC, and you think the Pope drew crowds? New York once had a visitor from overseas who got over half the population of the city to greet him. I'm talking about the subject of my next guest's book, The Marquis de Lafayette. And all right, that means about the same number of people as got free tickets to see the Pope drive through Central Park. But on a percentage basis, no one has topped him since he returned to the U.S. to mark the 50th anniversary of its founding, the Marquis de Lafayette. Sarah Vowell joins me now to talk about her book, Lafayette in the Somewhat United States. And as you can tell from the title, she again brings her inimitable take on American history that you may know from her appearances on This American Life, or her books like Assassination Vacation, The Partly Cloudy Patriot, or The Wordy Shipmates. Welcome back to WNYC, Sarah Vowell.
Good to be here, Brian.
And of all the historical figures we never think about anymore, why the Marquis de Lafayette?
Well, I mean, like you said, he was so beloved. I mean, and for good reason. I think, you know, when he came over here in 1777, he was this 19-year-old kid who came over to volunteer. I mean, partly because he wanted an adventure like all 19-year-olds. And also the British had killed his soldier father in the previous war, so he had a little bit of a grudge, you know. And even though he was this aristocrat who, you know, came over from Paris and Versailles, he really just kind of rolled up his sleeves and pitched in and endeared himself to Washington and the men and ultimately the American people.
We'd like to think about George Washington and them, but I think people forget that the war was won in large part thanks to the French fleet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we would be speaking English right now if it wasn't for the French, you know?
We're certainly not doing that.
You know what you need to win a war is you need gunpowder and soldiers and, you know, equipment and cannons and mortars. And Washington was sort of lacking in a lot of those things. So when the French, when the treaty with France was announced, the poor soldiers at Valley Forge, the ones who had lived through the previous winter, yelled, "Long live the King of France." And by the time the French troops come over and help Washington at Yorktown, there are more French people at fighting at Yorktown than Americans. And that was the deciding factor.
And it was evidence of that 1824 Lafayette mania at the Freedom Fries moment when France's role in winning American independence was so forgotten that got you on track for this book, that is, at the beginning of the Iraq War when everybody was disparaging France?
Yeah, I mean, I happened to be in the Berkshires during all of that, and I was at Melville's house, you know, where he wrote Moby Dick, and one of the things on display there is the dress Melville's wife was wearing as a baby when she was presented to Lafayette, and they held on to it all of these decades. And that sort of got me researching the return trip and ultimately led me back to the war.
So what was the return trip like from your research, this triumphant return to New York City in the 1820s?
Party every night. I mean, just to put it in perspective, I think it was something like 4,000 people who met the Beatles when they landed in 64, you know, and that was in a city of 7 million. So when Lafayette returned, it was like a party every night for over 13 months. And I mean, that was sort of what drew me to the story, not as much him, but just the American people's mania for him. And I think because at that point he was the last living general from the Revolutionary War, and because he was French, I mean, the country at that point was already on the road to civil war and so divided, especially between North and South. But because, you know, he was French, he belonged to all of us.
And New York, Lafayette Street in Manhattan, Lafayette Avenue in Brooklyn, which is just next to DeKalb Avenue, and the Kosciuszko Bridge, all foreign recruits to the Revolutionary War.
That's right. I mean, so many of these foreigners, I mean, partly they came over because they were out of a job. You know, Europe was at peace, and all of these professional soldiers were looking for work, and that's why von Steuben came over and trained the army at Valley Forge. And it's why, you know, Lafayette came over, because France was at peace, and he came from a long line of soldiers stretching back to the Crusades and Joan of Arc. And the only way you can get battlefield glory is, you know, in a battle.
Does help to be in a battle to get battlefield glory.
Yeah.
Says Sarah Vowell, who is the author now of Lafayette in the Somewhat United States. And I don't know if there are any of you listening right now who have a question or your own favorite Marquis de Lafayette story? 212.
Yeah, your own favorite Lafayette town.
212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.
I mean, if you have a favorite Lafayette town in Wisconsin, you're going to have to be more specific because I think there are three or four of them.
Really? In one state?
Yeah. I don't know how that works for navigational purposes.
And he was able to tour the country 50 years after the war that he fought in because he was a teenager when he left his aristocratic friends and family to join up, as you said, at the age of 19. So he could come back 50 years later and take a victory lap. And I guess your favorite line of his is, I did not hesitate to be disagreeable to preserve my independence.
I mean, that's kind of, I keep coming back to that line. He says it because his fancy father-in-law gets him a really boring job with the French court, and he wants to be a soldier, so he is rude to the King of France's brother and gets out of that job. But it sort of speaks to, like, one of the kind of through lines of the book is how much rancor there is in the American past and present. I mean, so much of Lafayette arrives in, so much of the founding moment is involves a lot of bickering amongst the founders. The Continental Army and the Continental Congress are often at odds. I mean, even the Continental Congress, one of the congressmen talks about how all we do is bicker, we waste a bunch of time. I think he says we murder time, which I think we can all identify with. But I forgot what the question was.
Well, in the road trip part of the story, as you say.
Oh, that's where I was going. It's like you read my mind or you read the book.
Maybe both.
While I was researching this story, I mean, I was so drawn to him just because he was this person everyone loved. And that's so rare in this country. And I thought I would take a nice little vacation through this story. But then when I was researching it, it happened to be during the government shutdown of 2013. So, a lot of the historic sites I was trying to visit, you know, battlefields where he fought, Independence Hall, were closed down. So it's really hard to celebrate the, you know, inventions of Independence Hall. This government focused on the separation of powers, like, it's hard to do that when the lights are off in Independence Hall, you know.
Here's a story from a listener who wrote in. Just last week, I visited the Samuel Van Saun House in Wayne, New Jersey, where I live. The Marquis de Lafayette headquartered there in the spring and summer of 1780 after the brutal winter for Washington's troops in Morristown. At the same time, George Washington was staying about a mile away in the Day Mansion. And you spend a fair amount of time in New Jersey on the road trip part of your book.
That's right. I mean, you know, the big battle that happens after Valley Forge, after our German friend von Steuben helps train the troops, the next big battle is the Battle of Monmouth, which was basically a draw, but that was an improvement over some of the other defeats before that. But that's the moment when Washington, you know, you remember the big moment of the New York campaign, the debacle of the New York campaign, and Washington yells, "Are these the men with which I am to defend America?" But by Monmouth, I think he can ask that question and be more or less happy with the answer.
And your take on history is not so much as someone who studied political history, but art history. So your research includes chatting with the Lafayette reenactor at Historical Williamsburg, and with Quakers who are unhappy that you're writing about a war at another reenactment. So your subject isn't so much the person Lafayette sometimes, but the prism through which we choose to view him and his fellow patriots of the time.
Let me write that down. That was pretty good. Yes. I mean, one thing about studying art history instead of political history, I think it leads to maybe more compassion, you know, especially with the founders, especially with someone like Jefferson. You know, how do you deal with Jefferson and all of his contradictions? I think if you come up in the arts, you're used to your heroes being a bit dented. Like, especially in art history, the most you can hope for in your heroes is like a garden variety philanderer. So like if you're a feminist who loves Gauguin, it kind of sets you up to deal with these founders, especially the ones who believed so much in liberty and freedom while, you know, enslaving some of their help.
Let's get a call in here from what some people call the Windy City.
Oh,
what
yeah?
I will call
heard of
the,
it?
The land of the enemy Cubs. Hi, Janet in Chicago. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Janet.
I'm a fan. I was wondering if you had seen Hamilton on Broadway and what you thought of the portrayal of Lafayette in the musical.
I have seen Hamilton. I think of all the Treasury Secretary musicals, it is definitely my favorite. the Lafayette in Hamilton is played by the dreamy David Diggs, I believe is his name, and I think he really captures the kind of joie de vivre of Lafayette, though he does have much better hair than the actual historical figure. But I mean, I loved Hamilton. Have you seen Hamilton?
I was in New York 2 weeks ago and I saw it, and I cried the whole time because I love all the Founding Fathers, but especially Hamilton.
Especially Hamilton? Yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess you would have that in common with the creator of Hamilton. I mean, sometimes during Hamilton, I was like, "There's an awful lot of Hamilton in Hamilton," you know.
Well, I had just read your book, and so it was it was such great timing because I read it, and then I got to go there. I was like, "There they all are! I just read about all of you."
Yeah. Well, it's nice. Or you could just paint a picture of them in your mind through reading.
Thanks, Janet. So do you envy, as a writer, someone like Lafayette who can write with no irony to his wife, "The welfare of America is intimately bound up with the happiness of humanity. She is going to become the deserving and sure refuge of virtue, of honesty, of tolerance, of equality, and of tranquil liberty." Boy, talk about American exceptionalism in it, at its birth.
He did write that on the ship on the way over. I mean, yes, I am envious of that. I mean, you can, you know, I actually think of this show kind of lives out those ideals more than just about any place that I can think of. But, I mean, I do talk about how, for me, I call it the file cabinet. Like, there's a file cabinet blocking my view of that country that he envisioned. And it's where the government keeps all the, like, Indian treaties and the Chinese Exclusion Act and, you know, everything we feel bad about and every betrayal of those ideals he was fighting for. But I still think they're worth talking about.
And on that note of ambivalence and hope, we will have to leave it with Sarah Vowell. Sarah, always great. Thank you.
I love being here, Brian. Thank you.
Merry Christmas to those of you who celebrate. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.